So tonight we're going to continue on with this, looking at the four noble truths, and by looking at the third noble truth. Remember, the first noble truth was that things are, by definition, by the way things are, if we really look at them clearly, things aren't perfect in the world, in our life, there's always going to be difficulty. We're always going to not be happy trying to operate in the world as it is, believing the cultural beliefs of the world as a way of making us happy. We know this doesn't work. And then the second noble truth was the root cause of all that is craving, clinging, trying to somehow operate in a way in the world where we ignore the unpleasant and only have the pleasant stuff. We operate in opposition to reality, essentially. And we, particularly, we crave, we cling to the pleasant and we push away the unpleasant, thinking that somehow that'll make us happy. But that doesn't work, because everything we cling to is impermanent and goes away anyway. That's a very brief summation of the first and second noble truths. And so now we go on to the third noble truth. And actually, this is a quote from the first discourse, the first time the Buddha ever taught. What he taught, what he was teaching to this small group of renunciates he'd been hanging out with in the forest before he went off on his own. He said, "Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, the remainderless fading and renunciation and release and letting go of craving." So in essence, this is what the third noble truth simply says, is if you want to stop suffering, if you want to stop trying to live in opposition to reality, just stop craving. That's it. I mean, that could be the end of my Dharma talk, right? But but I got to fill in another 45 or 50 minutes here. But it's like, oh, well, sure. Then you go, if you think about it for about 3 seconds, you go, yeah, sure. Well, what is, that's a tall order. and that's what the whole fourth noble truth is about, is, well, now, how do you actually do that? But what I want to look at tonight is, the Buddha, what the Buddha is saying here is, if you want to stop suffering, just stop craving. But what does that mean? What would it mean if you actually stop craving and suffering ended? What would that mean? What would that be like? This is sort of one of the central questions of Buddhist teaching. And then Buddha, when the Buddhist first started wandering, he encountered this person, and the Buddha was like glowing, had this halo, right, this massive halo, and this guy along the road said, who are you? And the Buddha, he simply answered, "I am the one who no longer suffers." That was his answer. That's how he that was the meme he wanted to use, perhaps, or the nickname, the one who no longer suffers. So what that means is he was enlightened. He was literally had reached the place where he no longer craved. He was an enlightened being. That's what it means to be enlightened, to no longer crave. But what does that mean? How could that be even? This is the most, like I said, this is the most difficult question. And unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, I don't know, it's not one we can answer in words. This is not something we can sort of logically figure out. It's beyond our mental capability to sort of just come up with the right philosophical view that would explain it and would everything would be okay. This isn't that kind of thing. A couple of things are quite interesting about this. There's one teaching that says the only person who can actually recognize an enlightened being is another enlightened being. So that's because only another enlightened being knows what it means to be, what that experience means. So to answer the question, you have to be enlightened. But once you're enlightened, you already know the answer. So you don't want to, catch 22, here we go. But that's what it's one of these unknowable things. And so what I want to do for the rest of the evening is sort of dance around the edge of this question as best I can. And there's lots of people who've tried to explain it using allegories and metaphors and all kinds of different formal ways of doing it. And so what I want to do is talk about all these different ways of trying to explain what enlightenment means, so that we can all at least have some sort of inkling of what this means. Because that's having that inkling is what gives us the incentive to practice. If this practice is about becoming enlightened, we better darn well have some idea of what that means. Okay, so here we go. First and foremost, this is from a book called What the Buddha Taught by someone named Walpola Rahula. This was recommended to me early on in my education, in my Buddhist education. And it's only a couple hundred pages, and it's very sort of step-by-step goes through the teachings of the Buddha with some quotes from various suttas and that sort of thing. But it's very sort of straightforward and simple, and covers all the main teachings of the Buddha. It has a little bit of a sort of a worshipful flavor to it sometimes, but that's okay. Anyhow, section, where he's talking about the third noble truth, he's talking about this famous metaphor about a tortoise and a fish who lived in a pond together, right? The tortoise told his friend the fish that he, the tortoise, had just returned to the lake after a walk on the land. Of course, the fish said, "You mean swimming." The tortoise tried to explain that one couldn't swim on the land, that it was solid, and that one walked on it. But the fish insisted that there could be nothing like it, that it must be liquid like his lake with waves, and that one must be able to dive and swim there. So this is an interesting metaphor for how we can't explain this in words, because we don't have the context to understand. Okay. And then Rapola Rahula goes on. Words are symbols representing things and ideas known to us. And these symbols do not and cannot convey the true nature of even ordinary things. Language is considered deceptive and misleading in the understanding of the truth. So this scripture says that ignorant people get stuck in words like an elephant in the mud. Interesting image, huh? We get stuck in words like an elephant in the mud. So this isn't explainable in words, which is now what I'm about to do for the next 40 minutes or so, because that's what we have to do. We have to see how we can approach it, grasp it in all these perhaps many different ways. And there's many analogies for this. Another famous teaching analogy that my old teacher, Swami Vishnu Devananda, used to use all the time. He said, imagine you mentioned to someone that you just had some honey. And this person had never tasted honey, and asked, well, what does that taste like? And you could go, well, it's sort of sweet, and it's sort of like agave, but it's not really, and so on. And you could try and explain all you want, and you can never really explain to that person exactly what honey tasted like. There's no words for that. But you take some honey, you put it on that person's tongue, they taste it, now they know. They don't need an explanation anymore. It's that, here's that image again of once you know, then you don't need the explanation. So that's another classical analogy that's often used in trying to explain what I'm trying to explain here. But there's many different approaches people have taken. In all throughout the Buddhist teachings, for instance, there's talk of what are called the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. And to be enlightened is to no longer be affected by the three poisons, to no longer experience them. You no longer experience greed, hatred, and delusion. Think what that would be like. I mean, the thought of that is like, wow, wouldn't that be a nice way to live? wouldn't that be an interesting experience to live in a place where you no longer experienced any greed, any hatred, any delusion? And that's the classic teaching of the Buddha. In other Eastern traditions, in this stage I'm talking with something called Jnana Yoga, which means the yoga of wisdom. There's a teaching called Neti Neti, which basically means not this, not this. And the idea behind Neti Neti is that, well, there's no way I can explain what it is, but I can explain what it's not. And if I'm just really good at saying what it's not this, it's not this, I keep understanding and looking deeper and deeper into what it's not, at some point, I'll come to the realization of what it is. By just constantly seeing what it isn't. It's a philosophical approach that's very intellectual. But it's interesting if you start thinking in those terms, because you start thinking, well, it's body sensation. No, it's not this. Because body sensation is changing all the time and it's impermanent and sometimes it's great and sometimes it's not. And it's not, I'm always happy with body sensation, for instance. Not this, not this, not this, not this. So it's a way of approaching it intellectually and philosophically if you are attracted to that way of thinking. So another way of describing it that you see in the suttas is the person who is the unborn, the ungrown, and the unconditioned. Not born, never grew, is unconditioned, in other words, is not affected by conditions. The uns make this sound kind of negative. But we're speaking in terms of relative reality here. You know, in relative reality, we're born, we definitely grow, change, and we're definitely conditioned by what we experience. But someone who's enlightened is not affected by that. They are unborn, ungrown, and unconditioned. It doesn't mean they weren't physically born and have a body. It's that it's more of a word game trying to describe a condition where the fact that you have a body doesn't make any difference anymore because you're enlightened. Okay. So these words, negative and positive, even, like I said, you know, this sounds sort of negative, negative and positive, these, but even those words negative and positive are relative terms, like this is good, this is bad. But to the person who's enlightened, those terms are irrelevant because in an enlightened being lives in a space and in a space of experience where they're not affected by relative things. They don't live in relative reality, they live in absolute reality. Relative reality is the world we live in. The enlightened being is functioning in a state of absolute reality. I'm not saying this is easy, but it's like I'm just trying to give you a variety of different ways to look at it and think about it, okay? Now, here's one. Enlightenment is not the result of the practice. Oh, yeah. Carolyn's giving me the eye. You're like, what? But you know, this is interesting. This is another way. It's another way to think. You know, enlightenment isn't the result of practice, because being a result implies causes and conditions. But once you're enlightened, you're living outside the world of causes and conditions. You're no longer affected by relative reality. It's an interesting one to take in, huh? Okay. Now, I want to actually turn to the sutta a bit here, because this is an interesting thing. And I think some of you might have heard me reading the sutta in a different context at some point, but this is one of those suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya where a Brahmin comes and is asking one of the Buddha's disciples, Sariputta, some questions. And he's trying to sort of pin down the Buddha in a sense. And so this is what the sutta says. How is it, friend Kassapa? Does the Tathagata exist after death? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this. The Tathagata exists after death. Then, friend, does the Tathagata not exist after death? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this either. How is it then, friend? Does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death? No, not that one either. Then, friend, does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after death? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this either. So here's the four I know. Exist, doesn't exist, both exist and doesn't exist, neither exist nor not exist. This is classic philosophical discourse, right? And no matter what this guy says, the Sariputta says, no, sorry, not that either, not that. And so the poor guy who's asking the question says, why hasn't the Blessed One declared this, friend? How come, what's going on here? And this is Sariputta's answer. Because this is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Therefore, the Blessed One has not declared this. But what is this really saying? I mean, saying, you know, here we are, this guy's trying to figure out what happens to the Buddha after death. Which, you know, greatest, what happens to everyone after death, right? And basically what Sariputta is saying, number one, is like, don't bother thinking about this because no one knows, you can't figure this stuff. Don't try and figure this out logically because it doesn't work. But this is even more important because all four of those answers, exist after death, doesn't exist, both exist and doesn't exist, neither of them, imply that there is something, some self that dies. But there's no self to die. I mean, there's a body, but no self in the sense that this guy's talking about that exists after death. How can this self exist after death if there's no self, well, before death? This is an interesting thought. When you start thinking about not self, then you start thinking about, well, if there's not self before death, then there's not self after death. Oh, that makes me, my brain hurt, right? But it's another pointing to what it means to be enlightened, to understand this at that, you know, on that level. Okay. So here's a famous metaphor. Okay. Think of a house oriented east-west. Right? The sun rises in the east and shines through a window, and the light hits the west wall. So we know, in a sense, what happens to that light. It lights up that west wall, right? Okay, now, same house, only there's no west wall. The sun rises, the light shines through the window. Then where does it go? What happens to that light? If there's no wall to stop it, what happens to that light? This is like trying to answer the question that the guy was trying to get an answer for. There's no, it's just the light's there. That's it. Enlightened being is like that light. He shines right through the wall, right through the wind. But there's no end to it. There's no limit. It's limitless energy. We think there should be some limit, some wall where, you know, it shines on it, and that's it. That's where it ends. But there's no end to it. There's no place for enlightenment to land. It can't be explained. Just like nirvana can't be explained. We can't explain what it means to be enlightened. Just like we can't explain what happens to that light when it shines through the window and there's no wall on the other side for it to shine on. It just keeps going. We know the light's there. We experience the light. We see the light shining through the window. But we don't know where it goes. We can't explain where it goes. We can't conceive of where it can go. Okay, yeah, here we go. Finally, this is at the end of the Metta Sutta, you know, the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness, the very end of the sutta, the last line, and where the last four lines of the sutta are basically describing what it means to be an enlightened being. If you actually take this practice, it leads to enlightenment, is what the Metta Sutta says. And it's, and the very last line is not born again into this world. Oh, so what does that mean? You know, and this comes into the whole understanding of reincarnation, which is a very difficult and somewhat misunderstood topic in our culture. And in cultures that where reincarnation is very common, it's often quite misunderstood as well. But basically, as this has been explained to me, whatever wholesome karma and unwholesome karma that we create in this life, you know, is essentially attached, for lack of a better term, to this what we'll call bundle of karmic energy that we're attached to as we, in this physical form, go through this life in this world. And we're affecting that bundle, and hopefully through our practice, I don't even want to use the word improving, but we're changing it in a positive way towards something more towards enlightenment. And so this physical body is gone. That bundle of karmic energy then attaches to another physical body, totally different personality, totally different everything, nothing to do with me, what I think of as me anymore. But it, and then that particular form with that particular bundle of energy goes through a life, a physical life. And that bundle keeps growing and enhancing and improving towards enlightenment. But then, here's the end of the Metta Sutta, the very last line. It says, when you, this enlightened being is not born again into this world. So once you're enlightened, once this bundle of karmic energy is enlightened, it has that particular physical form, that life. You know, the Buddha became enlightened and then he had another 40 years of life where he taught. But then it's gone. That bundle has done its job. It's just another thing that's impermanent. Even that bundle of karmic energy that might have gone through, you know, if you look at the scriptures, millions of lives, and who knows, many lives, a whole bunch. At a certain point, it's finished. It's done. It's reached it, what it had to do, which was to become an enlightened being and shine out into the world. And then when that the body that's connected to that bundle is finished, so is that bundle. It's gone. It doesn't take another form. The danger of this not born again into the world and similar words in other scriptures, in both in the Buddhist sense and in the, you see this very much in the Hindu teachings, in misrepresentations of Hindu teachings anyway, yoga teachings, etc., is that this very quickly turns into, oh, what I want to do is not have a body anymore. That's good. And so it turns into a way of rejecting the body. It turns into a way of thinking the body is bad. And that makes someone really unhappy. And you're basically now craving to not have a body anymore. You're caught in a deep, deep form of craving that is very anti-human. It rejects reality. I have a body. Thank goodness it's this body that allows me to practice. So you have to be very aware that this is how this idea is often misrepresentative in teachings in all kinds of different traditions, where the idea that of not having a body is sort of the goal. And actually, not having a body, just what happens, because something, this is an impermanent thing and it's gone. No big deal. Just life's, impermanence once again has occurred. Just like everything is impermanent. So is that. That's all that's about. It's not like saying bodies are bad or bodies are unnecessary or you should ignore the body. It's just acknowledging reality, that once you've become enlightened, that bundle of karmic energy will not take form again. It won't take another body. It's done. Complete. Finished. So these are all different ways. I just tried to dump all this stuff on you. All these different ways of thinking about this issue of what does it mean to be enlightened. None of them are sufficient, but all of them point in certain directions. Some of them may appeal to you more than others, and you might want to pursue some of them more than others. But the real question is, how do we start to understand this in the context of our practice? How can we get to a closer, a deeper understanding of this concept, these ideas, from our practice itself? And I want to now turn to Joseph Goldstein from his book Mindfulness. And this is, so he's talking, basically, this is in a section he calls Ways to Abandon Craving. If we want to reach enlightenment, if we want to be enlightened, we better abandon craving. Well, how do we do that? How can we make heading towards enlightenment part of our practice in a conscious way? So regarding the end of craving, the Buddha made a very obvious but often overlooked observation. When we focus on the gratification that comes from sense pleasures, desire increases. When we focus on the drawbacks of sense pleasures, craving diminishes. Seems pretty simple, huh? But how often in the midst of our involvement with the world of sense objects do we pay attention to whether we are further conditioning or deconditioning craving? This would be an interesting practice to bring to the world and see what we can learn from it. We can decondition, relinquish, and abandon craving through an increasingly refined awareness of the three characteristics. The more clearly we see the impermanence of all experience, the more we understand for ourselves the basic unreliability and ultimately unsatisfying nature of all phenomena. And through a sustained, wise attention, we understand more deeply the selfless, impersonal nature of this whole unfolding process, that nothing lasts long enough to be considered self. These universal characteristics are the drawbacks and dangers, the downsides of conditioned experience. This is one of Joseph's heaviest couple of paragraphs in this whole book, I think, sometimes. But what he's basically saying is, start literally looking and saying, what is it that catches you? What is it that you get caught craving? Often, over and 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 over again, and often totally unaware that you're even responding to a craving. It's become must have, a need, absolutely got to have it. It's like, of course, it's that of course thing of craving. If we can start to look at things and go, oh, every time I do that, I just condition myself to want to do that again. And then I can start making conscious choices. And I'm not saying, you know, you need to sort of, you know, beat yourself with a stick. That's not useful either. But it's just in our day-to-day life, we start to look at how we condition ourselves to continue craving things. And how by letting go of those things, we can decondition our habit of craving. This is a real practice, a difficult practice, but it's really part of the practice that we have to sort of look at. And the other, so that's one way we can put this understanding into practice. And the other way is the practice of mindfulness itself. You know, this practice of mindfulness that we're doing, consciously choosing to make part of a central part of our lives, leads us to start to see how things are impermanent. If we're, as we're meditating, after, you know, at first, as we learn to meditate, we keep getting caught in the content of what's arising. We keep getting caught in, oh, look at that, and look at this, and blah, 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 blah. But eventually, we start sort of looking underneath that content. And we start to see the similarity in all the objects that are part of that in that content. Everything arises, it's there for a while, and it's gone. And only mindfulness can allow us to see that level, to see below it. We can intellectually, I can sit here and say that out loud and you can all go, yeah, yeah. But to actually see it in our experience of mindfulness practice starts to take us deeper into the practice. Because we start to see how, you know, what Joseph called here, and we start to see those three things, you know, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self, as actual real things that we experience, as opposed to intellectual ideas. And so mindfulness is what leads us to that. Mindfulness is what creates the possibility that that occurs. This is why retreat is so important, by the way, because this is in retreat with that your mind slows down enough that you're able to actually consciously start to see this, start to experience this at some visceral level, not as an intellectual understanding, but as an actual experience of what's happening as you practice in your retreat life. Okay, so that's how some hints on practice. There's a couple of other questions about enlightenment I want to look at. One is this gradual? Does enlightenment sort of happen very slowly and gradually? Or is this like, poof, you're enlightened? Is it some sort of instantaneous event? Here's the interesting answer, of course. Yes. It's both. Okay, and I want to read, this is from Anleo's book, Satipatthana. And this is, he's using another classical image here of a chicken sitting on her eggs, trying to get them to hatch. And of course, all the chicken can do is sit there. Just sit there and sit there and sit there. Can't do anything to make those eggs hatch faster or slower or better. All you can do as a chicken is sit on your eggs. Sort of like what we're doing when we sit on our cushion. We can just sit on our cushion and sit on our cushion. The chick's sudden emergence from their shells depends on a gradual process of inner development through the hen incubating the eggs. Similarly, the sudden breakthrough to nibbana depends on a gradual process of inner development and mental cultivation. Just as the hen cannot directly cause the chicks to break their shells, the breakthrough to nibbana cannot be directly made to happen. Both will occur in their own time if the necessary conditions are in place. These passages clearly indicate that progress to awakening follows a gradual course. On the other hand, however, several realizations of stream entry described in the discourses take place in a rather sudden manner, usually while listening to a discourse given by the Buddha. And you see this all through the suttas, where these people are like, they come, they're sitting there, and the Buddha says, gives them a talk, and they're enlightened. In fact, you know, the very first time he gave a Dharma talk, which is when he taught the Four Noble Truths to his five buddies in the forest, one of them became enlightened during the talk. And the other four became enlightened soon thereafter. Which sort of sounds like, well, this is pretty instant, but these guys have been practicing for years and years and years and years and years. And this, so it sort of on the surface looked sudden, poof. But in reality, this, you know, this process of development had been going on for a long, long time, so that the conditions were ripe. The Buddha taught, the what he was teaching sunk in, and the chickens broke their shells. So the answer to, you know, this question, is it instantaneous or is it gradual? Yes, I think is the best answer to that question, because it's both. It seems at the moment it happens is, you know, and here's the interesting thing. We all in our practice have moments of enlightenment. We all have in our practice have moments or maybe chunks of time when something is happening that is just like different in some intense way that is just so different from our normal experience. These are moments of enlightenment. And my experience of these things is these always occur after I've been practicing fairly intensely for some period of time. But it's not like it'll be 4:30 in the afternoon and say, okay, now it's time for one of those enlightenment experiences. They just happen. I was, I'll give you a very small personal example here. It says, I was on a long retreat at IMS. It's one of the 6-week retreats I did. And this is quite deep into this retreat. So maybe 5 weeks, 5.5 weeks. So it'd been in a long time. And I was sitting very long periods. I was sitting 1.5 to 2 hours at a stretch, and then doing some walking practice, and then doing another. That's my practice had gone there. Not that that's better or worse. That's just what I was doing. And so it was, like 4:30 in the afternoon or something like that. And I got up from one of these long sits. And I said, boy, I really need to just go for a walk. Dinner's at 5-ish. I really need to go for a walk. Just get out into the, you know, if you ever been to IMS, there's these beautiful woods right behind IMS. This is in the fall. The leaves are on the ground. That is gorgeous back there. Sun is starting to go down. And I just start to walk. I'm just going for a walk in the woods, right? Well, no big deal. I'd gone on exactly the same walk and on the same paths many times over the past 5 weeks. And it was astonishingly different. That's the only way I can describe it. It was just like, oh. I mean, I was just like looking at the leaves and the sun shining on the leaves. And I actually had to stop walking several times in this walk. I just had to stop because walking was like, I wanted just to stop and look at the forest, the forest floor and the trees and the shadows. And there was something about this experience that was not normal, to use an inadequate word, that just it was like waking up to some other way of experiencing the world, of seeing this forest. I'd spent hours, countless hours walking in. So I was doing all my walking practices in the forest too. So I'd spent 100 hours walking in this forest probably by this point in my retreat, maybe more than that. And there was just something totally different about it that was just made me so happy. It was just like, wow. That's what I'm talking about. And the reason that happened wasn't that I decided to make it happen at that point. Had nothing to do with, you know, me logically deciding. This is as me having practiced really intensely for a long time. This happened. And I could, you know, if I wanted to reproduce that and make it happen again, I wouldn't have a chance. It was unique to that moment and that time and what was going on in my life and my practice at that moment. And that's what these experiences are like as well. But it was like a wake up to, oh, this is how you can see, this is how you experience the world in a totally different way. This is what enlightenment means to me. That experience was an experience of momentary, temporary enlightenment, perhaps, is my experience of it anyway. But not just me. This is from a book called First Buddhist Women. And I like this book first because it points to the fact that women are perfectly capable of doing this practice and of being enlightened beings. This was something that was unique to the Buddha in his time. You know, 2,500 years ago, if you were a woman, basically in North India, your job was to sort of, you know, take care of the kids and make sure the cow ate and take care of your husband. That was your job. And if you're lucky, next lifetime, you'll get a male body and you can study. But other than that, that was the way. And the Buddha said, no. Women are perfectly capable of doing this as much as men. And initiated many, many women into the Sangha. And in that Sangha of bhikkhunis, there was this tradition when a bhikkhuni became enlightened, she'd write what's called an enlightenment poem. Something that, using words, described the undescribable that she'd experienced. And this is a poem from someone named Patakara. When they plow their fields and sow seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. But I've done everything right and followed the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? So she's struggling with that question of how come I'm not enlightened? I'm doing everything right. I've done what I can to create the causes and conditions. Then she goes on. Bathing my feet, I watched the water spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed down the wick. When the lamp went out, my mind was free. So just totally normal life, right? She washed her feet. She watched the water run down, but she did it with a very totally concentrated mind. So she was practicing even just letting the water run down the side of the hill after washing her feet. And she put out the light. Enlightenment arose. This is a description as best she could of what occurred. But so the beginning of this is like I practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced. I couldn't understand why I wasn't enlightened yet. And she just kept practicing, kept concentrating the mind. It happened. And when it happened, she knew. That's the other thing that I understand is when full enlightenment or these experiences like I just described to you, when those occur, you know that this is something distinctly different from anything else you've ever experienced. It stands out so brightly. Okay. There's also this sutta. This is in the Majjhima Nikaya, and where the Buddha is talking about what it means to be enlightened, which I think, since this is what the Buddha is saying, it probably is a good way to look at it. He's talking here, first of all, about the four Brahma Viharas, which are in many suttas sort of a stepping stone along the way to really fulfill the Brahma Viharas in your life, in the world, is a stepping stone towards enlightenment. And here he's describing metta. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere. And to all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So imagine that. That's the state of your mind. Imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Powerful. And then he goes through the other three Brahma Viharas, you know, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And then he says, he understands thus, there is this, there is the inferior, there is the superior, and beyond there's an escape from this whole field of perception. When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. Bhikkhus, this bhikkhu is called one who has bathed the inner bathing. Bathed in the light of enlightenment. It's just such beautiful language. I wanted to just to share the language with you. So how do I sum this all up? We're all on the path. We're all practicing the Buddha's teachings. We're all awakening bit by bit. every day of practice, every day of awareness, of mindfulness, functioning in the world in a mindful way. It's moving us bit by bit, laying the groundwork, creating the causes and conditions such that at some point, one day, we'll truly awaken. It'll just happen. And it may not be this lifetime. Sorry. But you're creating the causes and conditions so that the bundled karmic energy that you are attached to, in a sense, I suppose it's the best words I can think of, improves, increases the possibility that in the next body, in the next form it takes, enlightenment will be attained then. So it won't be you in five lifetimes with that bundled karmic energy. Don't we have to get rid of that idea of this me being going on and on and on. But we're creating the causes and conditions so that another enlightened being will arise in the world. That's what's important. That's why we practice. Both for our own benefit, because it feels good. I'm sure you all understand and have experienced how good this practice is. As difficult as it is, and how sometimes we hate it and we struggle with it, all that stuff happens too. But it's like, oh, you wouldn't all be here tonight if you didn't understand that already, if you hadn't experienced that. But we're taking steps towards another enlightened being arising in the world. And how positive, how wonderful that is when that happens. The Buddha rose 2,500 years ago, and here we are still talking about him and his teachings. That's pretty amazing when you think about it. And it's this one powerful moment where he became enlightened, still reverberating through the world 2,500 years later. That's what we're working on, creating more of that. More often. So I want to finish, as I always do, with a poem. And I didn't even put the marker in because I read this poem so often. This is my absolutely favorite Mary Oliver poem. Mary Oliver is quite a devout Christian. But I think many of her poems are pure Dhamma. And interesting enough, this one is called Mindful. Every day I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It was what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise from such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the oceans shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. The best part is the middle here. To lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. That's what this practice is too. We're instructing ourselves in joy and acclimation. Can't think of anything better to do than that. Dedicate the merit of the practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.